this week's 51%, we meet an immigrant who shares the stories of other immigrant women.
I decided to tell those stories of those amazing 21 women, hoping that it will inspire young immigrants that feel that they do not belong.
Hear why one woman gave away money to Black women writers and learn about a move away from skin lightening creams. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Bilha Chesner-Fish is an Israeli-American immigrant living on Long Island and in New York City. Dr. Fish, a distinguished radiologist and founder of Manhasset Diagnostic Imaging and Pathways Women's Health, also established The Unbeaten Path, which provides programs for adolescents on topics such as anorexia, bulimia, sexually transmitted diseases, bullying, and mental health issues, for which they receive health credit in high school. Dr. Fish is a longtime advocate for community service and women's empowerment. In her new book, Invincible Women, Conversations with 21 Inspiring and Successful American Immigrants, she speaks with women from around the world about their journeys to America and the obstacles they faced. She shared her own story of immigrating to the U.S. with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill.
I left Israel after the army, servicing in the army. I left Israel and went to Italy, to Bologna, to study medicine, because in Israel there was only one medical school, one class, and they only took four girls. So I was determined. My father was a physician, and he was my role model. I went to Bologna, and I studied there. While I studied medicine, I studied the language. It was not easy, but it was a great experience. And then I followed my husband, who I met in medical school, to the United States. And there again, I had to perfect my English, and I have to take my exams again because the method taught in Italy was not accepted here. When I graduated from residency 12 years later and fellowships, I decided to open my own practice in Long Island, Manhasset. And it was a multidisciplinary practice and approach to radiology. Years later, I opened a women's center, which was really innovation. As I'm not aware that there was any other private women's center in America at the time. There I provided programs to teach women from surrounding 25 villages to be proactive about their health. I also had group therapy for women afflicted with cancer, and then I had a program for teenagers called the Unbeaten Path, where there were subjects related to their problem were discussed, and they got credit in health in the respective high schools. So this was my story, and as Israeli immigrant, I felt that in the time that we live, it is difficult for young women immigrants to achieve their dreams. And when with the universal bond of sisterhood and the growing voices of Me Too, I decided to tell powerful stories with which I hope to refute the policies that staff immigrants into faceless group. No matter where they came from, they always feel that they don't belong. And so the lack of protection, actually, facing the Dreamers and the removal of children from the U.S. southern border really touched me. And since my life mirrored theirs, I decided to tell those stories of those amazing 21 women, hoping that it will inspire young immigrants that feel that they do not belong.
One of the women who you talk with in your book is Jacqueline Murukatete, who immigrated to the U.S. to live with an uncle she never knew after her family was killed in the Rwandan genocide. Here you have a woman who's lived the true horrors of racism and discrimination, and like you were talking about, with children at the border being separated from their parents and just the administration's policies in general. I'm curious what her thoughts were on what's going on in the United States right now.
Well, you know, I think that she feels she was privileged to be here. And her entire purpose has been directed now to rehabilitate Rwanda and to better the life of the people that live there. Certainly all the women in my book, including Jacqueline, feel gratitude to the United States and believe that nowhere else they could have achieved what they achieved here. And they would like to be an inspiration to other young women and feel extremely badly to what's going on in the United States, the way immigrants are being treated. You know, it is certainly, as you can see what's going on now, it's much harder to be black. Yeah. Not only to be a woman trying to be achieving in a men world, but also you can escape from the color of your skin. And so carrying all this baggage and then coming to a country that you don't really know, you don't really identified with the culture or the language, was very difficult for Jacqueline. And so she empathized with the immigrants' problems today, and she was very willing to speak and to be a part of the book.
What was her healing process like?
Well, you know, I think that she has been one of the lucky ones that in school, I think she was well received. But the healing process is very long, and it lasts with you your entire life. I don't think you ever heal. But, you know, she was lucky to get into law school, to NYU. She is a lawyer, and she became the president of the Rwanda Society, hoping to rehabilitate Rwanda. So you can imagine that having a purpose is a part of the healing process.
I think in this day and age that we're living in, I can't talk to you and not talk about Wafa El-Sadr, who was a young doctor specializing in infectious disease in New York City at the beginning of the HIV and AIDS epidemic. Can you talk about what inspired her to specialize in infectious disease and her efforts to reach the unreachable?
So Wafa is a really incredible doctor, very dedicated. And she felt that of all the specialties in medicine, infectious disease, is, she believed at the time that she specialized in it, that she can help, that there is a cure, that there is medication, there is antibiotics. So she believed that she would be treating patients where she would see good results. Unlike patients, for example, that have cancer, that at the time that she practiced, were dying. The funny thing is that when she came to the United States to specialize in infectious diseases, and she chose Harlem Hospital, which is probably one of the most, is situation in the most deprived areas in New York, and people did afflicted with infectious disease there. But when the AIDS epidemic came, she found out that the cure was not there. There was a lot of shame and stigma associated with AIDS at the time. People didn't know how to handle it. And what she did was an innovative approach. She produced programs that included the family in the process of handling these patients. And 15 years later, when the drug for AIDS was discovered, which was not a cure by any means, but it's a way to survive. If you take the drug, you live a normal life. She then became the head of infectious diseases and public health in the Milman School of Public Health in Columbia University. And she started the ICAP, which is conceiving and producing those programs all over the world, especially for vulnerable countries like Sub-Saharan Africa. And with this program, she taught families how to deal with AIDS, and she saved hundreds of thousands of lives. So when I approached her to tell her story in view of the situation of immigration in the United States, and she's an Egyptian-American immigrant, she was very willing to cooperate, and she was proud to tell her story. This is a person that really has made a difference in the world, not only in the United States.
Yeah. What struck me was her reasoning for coming to the States. She's of the generation of Sadat and Mubarak in Egypt, but it wasn't their regimes or uncertainty that motivated her. It was finding her own path as a doctor. Did she share what surprised her the most when she made the move to the United States as a doctor and as a woman?
You know, I think she always talked to me about the fact that as a foreign graduate, you know, foreign graduates were somewhat discriminated against in the United States. And she feels that she has proved that no matter where you study medicine, you can achieve and you can make a difference. You should be considered equal. And I think that beside the fact that she had to adjust to everything else immigrants adjust to, which is the language, the culture, and being a woman at the time in medicine was not as common as today. Today, 50% of medical students are women. At the time, I was the only woman in radiology in my hospital at the time. So she has been working in a man world. She was a woman. She came from Egypt, and she was a foreign graduate. And I think she proved a point in many ways.
I've highlighted two women from Africa, but your book showcases 21 women from Asia, the Middle East, Central and South America, and beyond. What was the selection process for those you've included in your book?
There is a lot of things that interests me. I love music. I like art. I'm a physician, so I'm interested in science. You know, the universe is really a mystery, and I always was interested in understanding whether there is other life in other planets. So all these things intrigued me. Through the New York Times, word of mouth, and my life journey, I met different kind of people. And so I wanted this book to be diverse, to show that immigrants are contributing in many ways, in art and science, in law, and that a common thread is that they all give back. They all feel, all immigrants, all those women in my book feel that there's no other place but in the United States that they could have achieved. And they all contribute and they all give back, which is absolutely a wonderful thing about them. They give back to the community that supported them.
Was there anything that resonated with you long after you wrote the book?
Yeah, you know, what resonated with me is the fact that although we are American citizens, and we feel American in every way, our, you know, motherland, mm-hmm. where we came from, is always a part of us. And we feel that there is a uniqueness about us that we bring to the United States a flavor that would have not exist without us. The culture, for example, that Arun brings to the United States is Indian American, who is in charge of the Indian movie festival and art. She brought a flavor to the United States that was not there. People always thought of Indians as people that are riding on white elephants or something like that. Yeah. And she brought to the United States the Indian culture that was not as well known. And that's what I mean by us immigrants bringing the flavor that makes America special.
Is there anything that I may have missed that you wanted to touch on in this conversation?
Yes, I want people to understand, the readers to understand, that what American immigrants bring to the United States, especially now in the time of the pandemic, how grateful we are, we should be, and how empathetic we should be to those immigrants who risk their life for us. They bring our mail. They take care of people in the hospital and in old age homes. They deliver our food. They risk their life for us. And I just hope that reading those stories of those amazing women will empower other women to walk in their shoes and to try to fulfill their dreams.
That was Dr. Bilha Chesner-Fish speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her new book, Invincible Women, Conversations with 21 Inspiring and Successful American Immigrants. The book is published by Hybrid Global Publishing. When one white woman working in Hollywood received a surprise residual check, she skipped the bank and went to Twitter. She offered the money, $100 at a time, no questions asked, to support black women writers. During America's current racial reckoning, Biondria July asked whether Venmo donations offer a small but significant new age form of reparations.
About a week ago, I hopped on Twitter. It was a Friday morning, and I saw this tweet. In honor of Breonna Taylor's birthday and the work Black women do every day for this ungrateful country, I'd like to offer $100 to any Black women writers who'd like it. Post your Venmo, and I'll transfer until the money runs out. I was curious about where this money went, so I DM'd a dozen Black women who were in the thread. When you saw that tweet, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
To get my Venmo info.
According to the Washington Post, you would have to combine the net worth of 11.5 Black households to get the net worth of a typical white U.S. household.
I mean, you don't have to tell me everything, but what did you spend the money on?
I've been teaching incarcerated youth, actually, for the past 7 years. I'm a poetry teacher.
I've been covering a lot of the protests for the last 2 weeks, so I'm thinking that I will hold on to it just in case, you know, I need transportation to go cover another protest or...
Oh, I spent it automatically on some self-care, like my skincare.
A plane ticket to get back to New York.
So you're literally back in New York because of that money?
Yes, ma'am. Finally. Goddamn.
I wondered, is this performative or is she really about it? So I called her up on a Saturday morning to ask her a few questions. She asked not to be named. That's not the reason why she did this. Walk me through the moment when you had this thought, oh, I want to give away my residual check, to when you actually put out the tweet.
I feel like it wasn't that big of a decision for me. It just felt like it was just an unexpected check. Like, I wasn't planning on it. I didn't have any plans for it. And it was like, oh, I didn't even know I was going to get residuals.
She wasn't trying to be like, hey, I'm so sorry about what, as a white person, I feel like I owe it to the Black community. No, you know, don't try and tell people your reason. Like, you really want to, like, no, just be upfront. Just be upfront.
Like, I feel like there's a lot of things in which it's like, apply for this or like, tell us something that is, you know, why you deserve this money. And it felt for me important that there was no judgment on my part of whether someone, as long as someone told me that they were a writer, then I would just send it to them.
Well, ever since COVID-19, I don't have a job. And I've been having a lot of issues when it comes to unemployment that I'm hoping fixes itself within the next 2 weeks. A lot of the Black women writers I know are just like really struggling to either get their pitches accepted or financially, just due to the fact that like I know very few Black women who are on staff at publications.
How do you get people to like actually just give more money and start to like repair generational wealth that white people have accumulated? Because until it's in a big kind of constructive way, I think it doesn't seem enough, and it does feel performative.
Even if somebody were to just randomly start Venmoing Black women money, like that would make such a substantial like contribution to like the Black community, because Black women are doing so much work, not just like in the career wise, but emotional labor, and they have such little wealth in this country. It's just kind of like reparations to me, and I don't feel bad about asking for it.
But this isn't just about a handful of people getting easy cash, though. It's also about individual white people doing what they can to address the wealth gap in America.
This piece was produced by Samantha Hodder and Biondria July, with original music from Kolya Salter, as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project.
And now, KALW's Sandeep Roy brings us a piece about the color of skin.
When Black Lives Matter was grabbing headlines around the world, Indian actor and star of the American television series Quantico, Priyanka Chopra, tweeted her two bits. She said no one deserved to die because of their skin color. Fair enough, so to speak. But the only problem was Chopra also had done ads like this.
Pond's white beauty gives you a radiant pinkish white glow. Pale white or pinkish white, you choose. Pond's white beauty.
Pinkish white, huh? The skin tightening, lightening, whitening industry is a huge one in India. Many top Bollywood actors have been the faces of that industry. In 2017, it was estimated to be a $4 billion market and growing. And not just in India, according to your Monitor International. Around 6,277 tons of skin lightener was sold worldwide last year. But with Black Lives Matter, something might finally be shifting. And it's not just statues that are falling. The pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson has announced it will stop selling skin whitening creams. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. Ever since the Black Lives Matter protests erupted, these companies have been accused of double skin standards. They've issued lofty statements against racism and color discrimination on one hand, and sold fairness creams on the other. In India, the problem is huge, deep-rooted and cultural, and indeed much older than the fairness creams themselves. Marriage ads routinely grade women in levels of whiteness: very fair, fair, golden, medium, wheatish, anything but, God forbid, dark. Actor Nandita Das has been one of the few actors vocal against this. Every profile of her inevitably describes her as the dusky-skinned actress. As she told the website American Bazaar, she has seen it firsthand.
The makeup man or some cinematographer, somebody would come and say, can you lighten your skin, please? Especially if you're playing a middle-class or an upper-middle-class educated character. If you're playing a Dalit or a slum woman or a maid or whatever, then it's fine.
A few years ago, she lent her support to a Dark is Beautiful campaign. Last year, UNESCO launched an India's Got Colour campaign to talk about colour bias in India with its own catchy music video. The fashion and cosmetics industry would say, lighten up. Westerners go into tanning parlours to become darker. Indians pile on skin lighteners to become lighter. Same difference. Kavita Emmanuel of the Dark is Beautiful campaign said, not really.
It's not a matter of, you know, I want to go get my skin tanned today, so let me just go do it. And I'm not going to be treated differently because I've tanned my skin.
Color discrimination in India is palpable. You can say it's a colonial hangover, you can say it's about caste, but its effects are pernicious.
Say in jobs where beauty is seen as a requirement, for instance, a front desk job or a job as an air hostess or an actor, for instance, you know, definitely there is a bias towards, you know, wanting fair-skinned, you know, people, modeling industry, fashion industry, say that fair is beautiful.
It affects the self-esteem of children, being told constantly she's so pretty, even though she's a little dark. In fact, in Bengali, my mother tongue, someone who is dark is routinely called moila, a word that also means dirty. An animated short by Vinny Ann Bose that screened at the Third Eye South Asian International Film Festival in San Francisco last year made fun of the Indian obsession with a whiter shade of brown by asking, what's your brown number?
Oh God, look, 64. No wife, no job, all because of this. God, please change my brown number to 35.
Even Nobel laureate Rabindranath Tagore weighed in on the fair and lovely obsession over a century ago. You call her dark, he says in the song, but I have only seen her dark, doe-like eyes.
Kalo, tash jatoi, kalo ho, dekhechi taar, kalo horin chok.
But even those who love Tagore and the song hanker for that fair complexion, or wheatish at least. But what Tagore could not do, Black Lives Matter might have done. It's caused a pharma giant to finally pull these products. Johnson & Johnson says their only message is healthy skin is beautiful skin, no matter the color. Johnson & Johnson isn't the only player. And it's one thing to remove the product, but can that remove the desire for fairness? That comes from within us, not out of a tube. But we've got to start somewhere, fair and square.
India's got talent.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
This is Bird Note. For many folks in the Pacific Northwest, Western Canada, and Alaska, the return of the rufous hummingbird in the spring is cause for celebration. The deep buzz of their arrival marks the start of summer. In July, many of the fiery red adult males have begun their migration southward. Meanwhile, the female rufous hummingbird has fledged her first two nestlings and is just about to fledge a second brood. The chicks are now as big as their mother, making the walls of their walnut-sized nest bulge outwards at maximum capacity. It takes about 40 days to fledge each brood, from egg-laying until the young learn to fly. They learn to feed on their own through trial and error until they finally figure out which flowers offer the best nectar. Nearly all the rufous hummingbirds will begin their migration by late August, sipping their way south on high mountain wildflowers all the way to Mexico, until they whistle into our lives again in spring. Today's show, brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. If you ever miss a Bird Note, you can always get the latest episode. Just tell your smart speaker, play the podcast Bird Note. Learn more on our website, birdnote.org.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1615.